This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I am Meera Sivasuthi. It's our open monthly clinic, and that means we have a doctor in the studio who's here to happy to answer any of your questions. And today's specialization or area of specialization is your eye. In the studio joining us, Dr. Tara George. She's a consultant ophthalmologist and a retinal specialist. So we've got a whole lot of questions for you, Dr. Tara. And for those of you who'd like to ask Dr. Tara a question, the number to call us is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tara. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, Meera.
You know, Dr. Tara, we've had you on, you know, in the past. We haven't had you on for a long time now, but
it's been some time.
It has been. But over the years, over the 10 years that, you know, we've been hosting this show and, you know, having you on now, we've looked at very specific conditions. But what would you say comes out as an area of the eye or the health of the eye that concerns you, which has sort of changed over time?
I think what we see more and more of are, they're not really sight-threatening conditions, but more patients present with symptoms due to the use of devices, prolonged use of computer, dry eyes, things that we may not have seen much earlier. But because more and more people are having a lifestyle that where they need to use the computers a lot, their work, they spend a lot of hours on the computers. So symptoms like eye irritation, feeling tired, dry eyes, things like that are symptoms that bring them to the clinic. And they get very concerned that this might be something sight-threatening. Most of the time, these are just simple issues that can be addressed by lifestyle changes and simple drops. On the other hand, things that have not changed much are sight-threatening conditions like diabetic eye disease, which concerns us as ophthalmologists much more than things like dry eye, because those issues need to be addressed urgently and need to be prevented so that people don't lose vision.
Okay, but with all the awareness and all of that, I mean, we have NCDs, non-communicable diseases, which are a huge problem in this country, diabetes, hypertension, heart issues. With all the awareness, are you then saying that people are still not taking, you know, their eyesight seriously when it comes to diabetes?
Well, the issue is that the eyesight is not involved till it's too late. So they've got all sorts of other things to worry about. They may have a wound on their foot. They may have to go for dialysis. Their sugars are not controlled. They may have neuropathy, numbness. And so their eyes may still have, they may still have good vision. And unfortunately, diabetic retinopathy is a condition where the vision can be normal until it bleeds or you have swelling of the retina. And by that time, it's quite difficult to get them back to normal vision. So the issue is the patients are overwhelmed with the diagnosis and all the things they have to deal with. And they feel that the eye can be left to the last. And that's why, although the awareness is there, by the time they reach the ophthalmologist, it can be quite late.
Okay. Besides the ophthalmologist, and, you know, I'm sure there are not very many of you around to go around for. I mean, we're lead in terms of the number of diabetics in Southeast Asia, at least. They're definitely not enough of you to go around looking after people with diabetes. Can this responsibility be sort of shared with the GPs and whoever they're following up with? And is there, I mean, would you say it's a lack of education amongst the primary healthcare professionals, or is it not a priority?
No, I think that's something that has improved a lot over the years. Primary healthcare clinics have cameras that take photographs of the retina, and that's a simple procedure. And those photographs are graded by the primary care physician. And only if they feel that it's at a level that needs that they need to refer the patient to the ophthalmologist, then they do so. But we have so many diabetics, so even to get them to a camera, you need to set an appointment. We have mobile clinics, we have telemedicine. All that has come up over the years. Definitely the numbers of patients losing vision has come down, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Okay. So diabetes being one factor, any other sight-threatening conditions you feel that we should be talking about today?
So symptoms that retinal diseases present with specific symptoms, things like seeing a patch in your vision, okay, usually it's the central area of your vision, is not due to a cataract. And patients think that as they get older, as long as the vision is blur, it might be a cataract. But there are sight-threatening conditions like macular degeneration, retinal detachment. These things need to be addressed early. And symptoms such as having lots of flashes, sudden shower floaters, a patch, a dark patch, or seeing a crooked line in your visual field is something that alerts you that possibly the retina is diseased. And usually we advise patients to see the doctors within a few days and not wait for a few months before they come.
Can these be prevented if you see an ophthalmologist every year, perhaps?
No, this can happen at any time. So you just need to be aware of the symptoms. And the other thing is, with the eye, because you use both eyes, sometimes when one eye is involved, you may not realize it. So you need to be aware once in a while, just close an eye at a time and see whether your vision is good.
Okay. You spoke about sight-threatening conditions. What about, you know, we rarely talk about injuries, Dr.
Yes.
Tara. What are some of the injuries, common injuries that you see?
So work-related injuries top the list, I think, from what we see here in Malaysia. Not because the employers are not providing the necessary protective eyewear. But I think a lot of the workers find it cumbersome to use those kind of devices, like the special goggles. And we do see a lot of welding injuries. So the UV light actually burns the surface of the cornea. It does heal, but it is very painful, and they present in the middle of the night with severe pain, easily prevented by using proper protective eyewear. We have chemical injuries, and also when they grind metal pieces entering the eye, grass cutters who don't use protective eyewear. And all these are can lead to problems, minor problems, like the welding light is something that heals very well, but it's painful. But if you have a foreign body or a perforation in the eye, that can be disastrous. Mm-hmm. And it's easily preventable with proper protective eyewear. You also have those who don't wear seat belts, and you have where the windscreen shatters and you get glass pieces in the eye. Those are also things that we see less of nowadays, but it still happens.
Okay. We have Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist in the studio. It's our monthly open clinic segment, which means you can ask her any question you want regarding the eye. So give us a call. The number is 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now let's talk about the computer and blue lenses. We have a question on that one.
Hi, I'd like to know about the blue lens and for computer lens. What's the difference between blue lens, computer lens, and all kinds of lenses that good for work in front of the computer? Thanks.
Actually, there's no evidence that you need special lenses to look at the computer. You need anti-glare. So, of course, we don't have screens that most of the new screens on the computer are anti-glare, so that's fine. You need good contrast and good lighting. There's no evidence that using those special glasses are going to reduce the tired eyes or the dry eyes. But what is definitely known is the way you use your eyes. So whatever lens you use, you need to take frequent breaks from the screen. And that is usually the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, take a 20-second break and look at something 20 feet away.
20 feet away.
Yeah.
Okay. And does that really work?
Yeah, it does. Because when you're looking at something close by, there's a different set of muscles that are working, the muscles that are used for near vision. And if you just keep looking in that position, you actually get, your eyes get tired and people get headaches. And so alternating between near work and distant work does help to relax the eyes.
Will it affect your eyesight in any way?
No, it doesn't affect the eyesight, not for adults, but for children it does, because prolonged near work is one of the risk factors for progression of short-sightedness or myopia.
Okay, because of the distance in which they're focusing on.
Yes, near work.
And the child's eye is developing.
Yes.
Till the age of?
at least, so the maximum development is in the primary school age, but by teenage years it comes down. So the primary school range is when the maximum development is happening.
How does it make you feel that, you know, you have two-year-olds in front of an iPad? Does it concern you at all?
So I think it's known that it's not just for vision, it's for attention span, and children who are, they actually can get addicted to those devices. So we actually do not recommend a lot of near work for any child under the age of two, because that's one of the risk factors for myopia. In fact, the best thing for a child under two is just to play outdoors. In fact, for all primary school children, the recommendation is now to play outdoors for 1 to 2 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And that has definitely been shown to reduce myopia.
But we watch television in our era, Dr. Tara. All I remember is don't sit too close to the television set. How different was that?
So television, you don't sit 30 centimeters away from the television. Yeah. Near work is something at arm's length. Something that you look at arm's length is what is defined as near work. And nowadays, that's what most people are doing. Television was definitely not at arm's length.
Definitely not. Well, maybe for some people, but we had naggy parents who made sure we didn't sit there. Okay, we have a question or comment from Kelly. Kelly says, what is the best solution for dry eyes? Is there a lifestyle change that I can do to help instead of continuously using eye drops? I'm in my 20s, no diabetes, relatively healthy. I was told previously by my optician that this is the reason behind why my vision keeps deteriorating, the eye drops.
No, I don't think it would be related to the eye drops. If she's talking about her short-sightedness, those are genetic factors and things that may not be within our control. Now, if she's in her 20s, it's unlikely that the dry eyes is due to reduced production of tears. The reduced production of tears usually happens in the perimenopausal age group. So in her case, it most likely is due to a lot of evaporation of the tears, which is again related to prolonged near work. Now, when your eye produces tears, what distributes the tears across the ocular surface is your blinking action of the eyelid. It's like a wiper going across your windscreen. So when you read or are at the computer for long periods of time, you actually blink 3 times less than what you would do naturally. So when your eye is open, you're not blinking, and especially if you're looking at something at a higher eye level, your eyelid aperture is open wide and there's a lot of evaporation. It'd be worse if you're sitting in a room where the aircon is blowing into your face. So there's a lot of evaporation. The surface of the eye dries up and you get a dry eye. So this is more of an evaporative dry eye rather than the fact that your body is not producing enough tears. And that is easily addressed by a change in the way you use your eye.
Okay.
Again, the 20-20-20 rule. Now, using the eye drops do not damage the eye. But there are different types of artificial tears. You have the ones with preservatives and the ones that are preservative-free. So prolonged use of the drops with preservatives sometimes may irritate the surface of the eye and you may have some discomfort. So if you're using it on a long-term basis, it might be better to use the preservative-free drops.
Okay, Kelly is sort of clarifying. She says, my dry eyes is the reason for the deteriorating eyesight and my eye power keeps increasing and the optician says it's because of the dry eyes.
Now, the power won't increase because of the dry eyes.
Okay, fair enough. So there you go, Kelly. So she just needs to continue using the eye drops?
Yes, but if she needs it very frequently, it's better to use the preservative-free drops and change the way she uses her eyes.
Okay. 20-20-20, that's something we're going to take away at the end of this show for sure. Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist in our monthly open clinic segment. If you have a question for her, give us a call. The number is 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll come back and find out a little bit more about astigmatism, LASIK, which is something that's always being talked about, and maybe even supplements for your eyes. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our monthly open clinic segment with Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist. She's in the studio to answer any of your questions in relation to the eye. So give us a call if you have one. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a question here, Dr. Tara. I have Graves' eye disease, where the eyes are protruding. Can this be treated? Maybe you want to give us a background of what this disease is.
So it's an eye manifestation of the patient having a thyroid problem. In the initial stage, it's usually when the thyroid hormone is at a high level. But even when the level comes down, the eye manifestation will still be present. It basically is a condition where the soft tissue around the eye, the muscles and you know, the fat and all the things that are in the orbit, they swell up, they increase, and therefore the eyeball itself protrudes forward. Now, unfortunately, there's nothing much that we can do to totally revert and make the eye go in. Sometimes it gets better as the patient is treated. Now, if there are certain conditions where we definitely intervene, one is when there's a lot of swelling and the eyes are really bulging forward and the patient can't even close the eyelid, and that would cause some wounds on the cornea. The cornea gets abraded. And in those kind of cases, we intervene. The other is when the swelling is so bad and the nerve gets compressed, we also intervene. And those are quite aggressive interventions. It can be medical with steroids and medication, or even some form of surgery to decompress and enlarge the space for the in the orbit. So they're quite intensive treatments. Recently, there have been some advances on different forms of surgery to relieve the fat around the orbit so that the eyeball moves in a little. But these are quite major surgeries. And if this is just a mild cosmetic thing without any of the other issues I've mentioned earlier, usually we don't do anything. So if it's something very obvious, you can consult. Usually the doctors who deal with these are oculoplastic surgeons, doctors who do plastic surgery around the eye, and they'll be able to advise you better.
So this is when you have hyperthyroidism.
It can be hyper, or even when the patient after hyper, they may go hypo, but the eye presentation can still remain.
Even though you have it under control?
Yes.
I see. Okay. Because normally it's steroids for managing hyper or hypothyroidism as well.
That's thyroid. They give some other medication to lower the thyroid hormone in the hyper stage, and they give thyroxine to replace the low thyroid hormone in the hypo stage. But the eye manifestations do not follow what the thyroid pattern is. They can be totally independent. So we have patients with low thyroid level who have the protruding eyeball because they may have had high thyroid levels earlier.
Right, okay. So it is completely independent, but
it's caused by the thyroid eye disease.
Okay, sure. Next question. If reading or using a device under the dark, is there a chance of getting glaucoma?
Yeah, I think this was a big issue where I think there was a viral message that went around.
About I'm surprised my mom didn't send me that one.
It was quite a few years ago about someone losing vision from acute glaucoma. So the mechanism of acute glaucoma is that the pupil gets mid-dilated, and because of the shape of the front of the eye is narrow, the fluid within the eye can't drain and the pressure just shoots up. That's acute glaucoma. It's to do with the structure of the front of the eye. So anything that makes your pupil stay mid-dilated can trigger an acute glaucoma attack in someone who's predisposed. There's even been reports and studies showing the time how the moon, you know, the ambient lighting of the day, if it changes at 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. and your pupil dilates and it stays at mid-dilated, we've seen a spike in patients who present with acute glaucoma.
Really?
So, yes, there are seasons when we have three or four patients presenting with acute glaucoma. So it's got to do with how the pupil reacts. You see, when the light is dim, your pupil will dilate slightly. That's a natural response. And in these predisposed individuals, if they reach that level where it triggers an acute attack, they present with acute glaucoma. So it's not using the handphone that caused it. It would have been something to do with the lighting in the room.
That triggered.
Yes, the trigger. So it's when your pupil gets into a mid-dilated position in a predisposed individual, where that's when an acute glaucoma attack happens.
What do you mean by acute glaucoma?
So acute glaucoma is when you have a sudden rise in pressure. Usually it's very high, above 40 millimeters. They have headache, vomiting, they see halos, everything is blurred, and it's actually an ocular emergency.
Okay, what will you do?
So we lower the eye pressure medically. We may give IV medication. We do some laser procedure on the eye to increase the drainage of fluid so that you abort the acute glaucoma attack.
But this does mean that the person now has glaucoma.
Yes, he has acute glaucoma. Whether that would go on to chronic glaucoma, after you treat the patient, you wait and see.
Okay, all right then. Next question, this is from Leng. Leng says, my friend who works in an office setting always complains of eye pain. It's really painful. And when she did her eye checks every year, each time the results are, you know, they say there's nothing wrong with the eye. This has been going on at least once every 2 weeks for over at least 10 years. What else can she do to find out what's wrong?
So eye pain is something that reflects problems on the surface, okay, because things happening inside your eye don't cause much pain. A very common cause for this would be just clogged up oil glands, okay? So our eyelashes have oil glands, and sometimes the oil doesn't drain very well, especially in those who use a lot of oil, eye makeup, mascara, eyeliner, don't remove it properly. So the pores around the lash area get clogged up. And it's actually like a white head, okay? And those clogged pores, imagine a white head in your eye. So when you blink, it's very painful. Mm-hmm. You feel something is poking your eye. And the oil that collects around the lashes actually has a pH that is similar to soap. So it's like soap getting into your eye and you have this burning kind of feeling. So those are the common reasons why people come in with pain. And when the oil is less, it's not painful. When there's an excess collection of oil, it's more painful. It's a very simple issue to address. You just need to apply a warm compress over the eyelids whenever you wash your face in the morning or especially and at night. And that would loosen up the clogged up pores and the symptoms would be relieved. And of course, remove all makeup properly at the end of the day.
But will it recur?
Yes, it is something that comes and goes because it's just like your skin. The pores get clogged, the oil collects, you have some discomfort, but it's not dangerous.
Okay. Just very annoying, I can imagine, for 10 years, my goodness. Another question. Okay, we have Chris on the line. Chris, you have a question for us.
Hi, doctor.
Hi, Chris.
Okay, my question is Graves' disease, right? Can it be inherited? Is it in the genes?
Okay, thank you very much.
And one other question. What is the first sign that, you know, if somebody has it, right, how do you detect it? I mean, how do you prevent it from...
Thank you very much.
Worse?
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
This is the one that's related to the thyroid, as you explained just now.
So the mechanism of Graves' disease is actually an autoimmune disease where there are antibodies that target the different receptors in the thyroid as well as the similar receptors are present in the eye. So it is a form of autoimmune disease. And there is evidence that autoimmune disease can be hereditary. So if someone has Graves' disease, there's a chance that other people in the family may have some other form of autoimmune disease. There's a whole spectrum of them. So they may not necessarily have Graves' disease, but they can present with other autoimmune diseases.
Okay.
So not directly hereditary in the terms that it's not a direct genetic transmission, but there is a tendency for autoimmune diseases to happen in families.
And they can present in many types
In other forms of autoimmune disease.
Okay, and such as
lupus. We have rheumatoid arthritis,
psoriasis,
myasthenia, psoriasis, yes.
Okay. Another question from KS. KS is saying, hi, I'm listening to your talk show at the moment. May I know what causes red veins on the white of the eye? And KS has actually sent us a picture, but unfortunately we can't see it. But red veins on the white portion of the eye.
Yes. So basically those are dilated blood vessels. And that's a whole lecture in itself. The issue is it something serious or is it something that you may not be something very bad? What concerns us is if that red vein is associated with visual symptoms. If you are sensitive to light, what we call photophobia, that would indicate that there is something going on inside the eye, such as an inflammation or the cornea is involved. So the red eye is just a sign that something is happening in the eye. It doesn't tell you where it is. In fact, a bright red eye is less dangerous than a slightly pink eye. The slightly pink eye shows that there's something happening in the iris or in the cornea, which is more sight-threatening. A very bright red eye is just usually a capillary that has burst on the surface of the eye, and that's not serious at all. So when he says that there's these dilated veins, if there are no other symptoms except just for the dilated veins, it may not be anything significant. It can just be dry eye. Sometimes it can be allergy if it's gone somewhere and there's, it's a dusty environment. The eyes react in such a way. So if there are no other symptoms and it's just that the vessels are slightly dilated, then it may not be anything significant.
Okay. Just to digress a little, Dr. Tara, I'm just thinking out loud. They do say through the eye you can actually see the brain. How much of the brain can you actually see through the eye? And have you ever, picked up any brain issues when, examining somebody's eye?
Yeah, I think the eye is the window to your body. That's definitely true. There's many a time where, as an ophthalmologist, we have picked up things happening in the brain. The optic nerve is what connects the eye to the brain. And a small portion of the optic nerve is in the eye, and the rest, so 90% of it, is in the brain. But whatever happens in the brain, say if the brain pressure is high, if there's a tumor, if there's a bleed, if there's an infection in the brain where the pressure in the brain builds up, that built up pressure is transmitted along the optic nerve and we see it in the eye as a swollen optic nerve. We also can see it sometimes as an atrophied or an optic nerve that is sort of dying off because it's been pressed on by something in the brain. So there's many a time where patients come to us and we are the ones who order an MRI of the brain and discover that the patient has a lesion in the brain and then they are referred to the neurosurgeon. In fact, there was once a patient was sitting in us at our examination room, and while I was looking in his eye, I just saw the swollen nerve and he actually collapsed in front of us and he was having a bleed in the brain. So as an ophthalmologist, we are aware that we may be picking up things and we liaise very closely with our colleagues. And, they're very kind to always entertain whatever our findings.
Yep. So what links the eye and the brain is really the optic nerve.
Yes.
And that's also a sort of a not so a defective optic nerve, if that I may use the word, also is a sign of glaucoma.
Yes. But in that case, it's purely in the eye. This time, the pressure is coming from the eye onto the optic nerve. In the conditions where the brain is involved, it's the brain that's pressing on the optic nerve.
Okay, not the other way around.
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. It's our open clinic, monthly open clinic with Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist. If you have a question about the eye at all, give us a call. The number is 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a question on LASIK.
The question maybe about the price and the safety of the LASIK procedures. Sometimes people out there need to be more sure that the LASIK is not so painful. Like me, I also love to do LASIK in one day, but price quite high in some clinics, and the procedures is maybe painful, or maybe some people say not painful. That like, and we as a common people never do the LASIK, so. The most question maybe the price and the level of painfulness of the treatment.
The discomfort and the price, Dr. Tara.
Okay,
which one are you going to go with first?
So what I can't answer is the price, because you have many centers offering it. You have different types of machines. They have promotions at times. So I can't answer on the price. You need to consult each center. But I can tell you that about the procedure, it's not painful. Now, pain threshold differs in different people. The area that they are operating on is on the cornea, and the cornea has very few nerves. So it's a painless procedure. It's more of anxiety and the feeling of lying under a machine and having something pressing on your eye. It's more of an anxiety issue rather than pain. It's not painful. So if you're reassured that it's not painful and you're not someone who's very anxious, you can go ahead for the procedure. But it's something that needs a lot of counseling. The consent form for some refractive surgery procedures, I think, is about 3 or 4 pages long because you need to understand what you're getting into. And there's no easy fix for these kind of problems. So the patient needs to know what they want. They want to be spectacle free, but they need to understand that they can't have perfect vision and be spectacle free. They may be able to be spectacle free. That means if earlier they had get up in the morning, they're blind and without their glasses. Now when they get up in the morning, they can see, they can read their phone, they can have a look around. It's not a problem, but they will not have that perfect vision which you got when you wore your glasses. That usually happens, but you can manage. So the personality of the person is important. If they are someone who's highly strung, who wants perfect vision at all times, then they may not be suitable because they'll be disappointed after the amount that they spend and they don't achieve that perfect vision. But if they understand that their aim is to be spectacle-free and they're willing to take the risk, then they may be a suitable candidate.
Okay, we'll come back and find out more about LASIK as to who is really suitable and who isn't, because not everybody should be doing LASIK, really. Yes. And some of the, 3 pages long, that must be a lot of exclusion and disclaimers. Yes. I can imagine. So that's coming up next. If you have a question for Dr. Tara George, number to call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. In the studio with me in our monthly open clinic segment, Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist. We're discussing your eye. Any question you have about your eye, give us a call, 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have Fu on the line. Fu, you have a question for us.
To check with the doctor, because I love to read, but now I'm approaching 60. So the problem is when I start to read, my eyes get tired. What are the things that a person can do to mitigate that?
Sure. So we're assuming that you read books and not your gadget, from your gadget.
Mostly books and also gadgets, but the gadget I don't read that much. It's mainly from books.
Okay, fair enough. Dr. Tara?
Yes, so as you get older, your muscles get tired easily. I think we know that for sure. Your eye has 6 muscles around it, and there are 2 muscles that work when you look at something at a near distance. And so when you're doing that, the muscles get tired and your eyes feel tired. To top up, you have this problem of dry eyes where you're reading and there's evaporation, and so you get a discomfort on the surface. So you have tired muscles, you have the surface that's uncomfortable, and all that makes your vision blurry and you just feel that you can't read. Most patients say they feel like just closing their eyes at that point in time. So again, it's not really to improve your eyesight. We unfortunately can't do anything about the natural cause of things that happen, but you can change your reading habits. Once again, I think I can't emphasize more on the reading habits, the 20-20-20 rule.
Even when you read a book?
Yes. So after a certain age, you'll find that you can't read beyond 20 minutes. You will feel tired, but you're only meant to read for about 20 minutes and then you're supposed to take a break. So pushing yourself to read beyond that will give you symptoms.
Okay. We have Andrew on the line. Andrew, you have a question.
What is the relationship between eye nodules and neurofibromatosis?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, so neurofibromatosis is a condition where you get, there are different types, but you basically have problems along the peripheral nerves. The eye examination will give you an indicator that this person has neurofibromatosis. So you see these nodules on the iris called Lish nodules, and you only see that when you see an ophthalmologist. So you need to look at the eye under a slit lamp where the view is magnified, and you see these nodules. And when you see that, you know that this person has neurofibromatosis. Now, this is usually important in children because they may come for an examination. They may not have the manifestation of neurofibromatosis yet. And as an ophthalmologist, as I told you, we look in the eye and we know what to advise the parents. And we know that we need to refer these children to a pediatrician to tackle the problem of neurofibromatosis. Okay.
We have a question here from Surinder Mohan Singh. He says, my daughter is 6 years old and she's short-sighted. She needs to wear glasses and the power is 400. Is there a way to reverse this in a toddler? Well, 6 years is not really a toddler. It's almost a young child, right?
Yeah. So this is, again, big issue of myopia in children. We're seeing more of it, again, related to near work. There's been a landmark trial that showed that spending time outdoors reduces the progression of myopia. So the first thing is let your child play outdoors for 1 hour definitely a day, if possible 2. It doesn't have to be at a fixed stretch. It can be 30 minutes in the morning, 30 minutes in the evening. Then there are some eye drops now that have been shown to reduce the progression of myopia. It will not reverse it. So if she's already minus 4 diopters or 400, it's not going to make it go away, but it would reduce the progression. And those drops actually work on the muscles related to near work. It's given once a day at night. It's a diluted concentration of atropine eye drops. And the study was actually done in Singapore, and they found that this definitely helps because they have so much of myopia there.
Yes,
it has to be given for a long period of time, most likely the entire primary school age. It has hardly any side effects, and it has definitely been shown that, together with playing outdoors, has been shown to reduce the progression of myopia. But it's not something that you can just use for 6 months or a year and say that it works. You have to use it for the period that the eye is growing.
And myopia is very much genetic related.
So the genetic component you can't do anything about, but you can do all these other measures.
To slow down the progression,
yes,
as you said. Okay, we have Laura on the line. Laura, you have a question.
Yes. So, hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I have this eye floater. So, like, this black string floating around my eyes, and I've been having it for a couple of years. And I'm just wondering if it's dangerous. And another question is whether or not it's dangerous. Is there any way to get rid of this eye floater?
Okay. Thank you very much, Laura. And just to build on, Lynn has also texted in to say, she's asking how to deal with floaters. She said, can it be operated on or does it go off over time?
So floaters are one of the common symptoms that patients present to us with. Floaters are things that move in the vitreous gel. Now, 4/5 of your eye consists of collagen and water at the back of the eye, which is called the vitreous. And when you're a young child, this is solid, like solid transparent jelly. But as you get older, it liquefies, and then you see the interface between the collagen and the liquid as floaters. So initially, they are just maybe, you know, some say as flies, mosquitoes, little lines floating around in the eye. They are just degenerating vitreous. It's not a disease, it's just a natural change. It's just like getting gray hair at an earlier age. But as time goes on, this gel will liquefy further and collapse inwards. And then you may get a very large floater, indicating that the whole gel has moved forward. Now, when you have just a few floaters, you may not need to take it very seriously, but it's always good to have a checkup just to make sure that your retina is fine. When you have the sudden shower of floaters or the sudden big floater, you need to come in and have a checkup, not because of the floater, but because we need to look at the retina and make sure that's fine. So floaters in itself are not dangerous. If you have sudden floaters within a few days, then we are worried that whether there's bleeding in the eye, because we don't know whether it's just the collagen or whether there's something that has bled in the eye. So when you have sudden floaters, I would advise you to see the doctor. But if you just have a few floaters, usually we don't do anything. Most of the the time we advise the patients to learn to live with it.
It's so annoying, Dr. Tara. I cannot imagine.
Yes. So when nearly a lot of people, I would say 80% of the people that are listening have floaters, and they learn to live with it because what you do for it is quite invasive. So there are some centers around the world where they do a floaters-only vitrectomy. So they do a surgery where you're operating in the back of the eye to remove the gel. And now this is quite risky because you're operating on the retinal area. So the patient takes the risk if they want to do such a thing, not done very commonly. The next thing is a special type of laser that may break up the floater, the large floater, into smaller floaters. These are offered in certain centers, but you need to discuss the risks and the benefit with the doctor.
Okay.
So most of the time, we just leave it alone.
Sure. Question for someone who's taking steroids for the long term, minimal change disease patient. This is coming from them. What are the side effects that they should look out for aside from cataract?
Yes. So
what's minimal change?
Minimal change is a kidney disease. So I think they're taking steroids for an immune disease affecting the kidney. Steroids can affect the eye in several ways. One is cataract, what she said. It can also raise the eye pressure. Very rarely, it can cause a condition in the retina called serous retinopathy, where fluid collects in the retina. Usually, if there's a cataract, it's easily addressed. We always need to see why the patient is taking the steroids. So a minimal change disease is something that you can't say, I would like to stop the steroids. But there are many patients who just buy steroids off the counter, and those kind of cases will tell them to stop it. So in her case, it's just regular checkup. We advise patients who take long-term steroids to check their eyes twice a year.
Okay. Question, my son is 18 years old and has a mild green color blindness. And my son wants to pursue engineering, and we knew there's a spectacle to eliminate the mind colorblind issue. Is this true?
There are certain centers that offer these kind of devices to help people who have red green colorblindness to perceive colors as how we do. But they're not something that you can use all the time. So it might help you function better in certain conditions. But to work as an engineer and to do that as your full-time job, you need to see what the requirements of that center are. So you have airline pilots, you have people who want to do engineering, and that particular faculty will decide whether it is okay or not. So each, like for airline pilots, there are certain, each airline have their own requirements. So of course, there are, those devices are available in certain centers even here, but they don't eliminate the problem totally. When you're not using that, it's back to what you were before.
Okay. Question, may I know why my mum's eyes is always wet? She always needs to use a tissue to tap on her eye because it keeps tearing.
One of the possibilities could be that her duct that drains the tears, which communicates from the inner aspect of the eye into the nose, might be blocked. This is called the nasolacrimal duct, and it's common in older individuals. You diagnose it by doing a test called syringing, where we flush that system with a bit of fluid. And if you feel the fluid in your nose and mouth, that means it's not blocked. So just looking at externally, we won't know whether it's blocked. You have to do that test called syringing to see whether the duct is blocked.
Okay, so otherwise it drains through the nose.
Yeah, so normally if you put an eye drop, you feel it in your mouth because that's the drainage system. If it's blocked, you get excessive tearing.
Sure. Let's come back to LASIK. Dr. Tara, who shouldn't be, or is everyone a candidate for LASIK?
No, obviously not everyone is a candidate. First thing is, I said, what your visual requirements are. That's the most important. Secondly, the centers that do this would assess you. They would look at your corneal thickness. They would look at your pupil size. They would explain the side effects of LASIK, things like glare and halos, especially at night. They would also explain about the dry eye. And they would also explain the risk of overcorrection or undercorrection based on how much of refractive error that patient has. There might be a need to do an enhancement, to do a top-up later if you don't get the full correction. And there's some patients who definitely are not candidates. These are people who have keratoconus. So keratoconus also is a condition where the patient might be short-sighted or have astigmatism. But those patients do not go for LASIK. So one of the criteria to have all these kind of refractive surgery like LASIK is that your power must be stable for at least about a year.
Okay. Speaking of keratoconus, we have a question on that one.
How does a keratoconus patient improve their vision? And I understood that keratoconus patients are not recommended to do LASIK. Then if I want to have a perfect vision, what are the other alternative I can take?
Yeah, so he's right. Whoever advised this person that they should not have LASIK because you do not do LASIK for keratoconus. So there are different ways patients with keratoconus present. I mean, different stages. So if it's in a stage where you can correct it with a special type of contact lens, that's what they use. There's something called cross-linking, which is a procedure to stabilize the cornea to prevent the progression of keratoconus. In very advanced stages, they even do something called a corneal graft. So it depends at what stage this person is at. Most patients are on those special contact lenses.
Okay. Let's talk about diet for the eye. I mean, we know we have to reduce our, or at least apply the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, take 20 seconds off your gadget and look 20 feet away. What about diet? For children, for an example, does diet help at all with your eyesight? And that whole carrot thing, does it really work?
No, I think it's about getting a balanced diet. And for vegetables and fruits, yeah, what helps the eye is the lutein, the zeaxanthin. These are different components in your fruits and vegetables. So taking multicolored fruits and vegetables, in fact, taking too much carrots are not good, actually. So taking green leafy vegetables, different fruits, fish, oily fish that has a lot of omega-3, flaxseed, nuts, things like that are good for the eyes. So if you do not spend your time outdoors, if you're on your near work the whole day and you decide to take all these supplements, it still doesn't work. You need to look at it as a whole.
Holistically. Yeah. Okay. Would you have a message for us on the eye?
So I think take care of your eyes. Right from childhood, you see that it plays a part. Prevention of myopia, play outdoors. Don't just be confined to reading and your devices. Be aware of your visual symptoms. And if you have any family history of ocular problems or if you have medical problems like diabetes, do remember to get regular consultation.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Tara George, consultant ophthalmologist and retinal specialist in our monthly open clinic segment on the eye on the Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.